my name is Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, bringing you a Floydcast number 20, June 30th, 2014. Been watching soccer. It's been a week of soccer. The end of the round-robin play happened over this last week. Round-robin play is something that soccer has that not too many other sports have. I'm trying to think of a sport that has round-robin. Oh, I know one. Ice hockey at the Olympics, and probably field hockey. Probably in general, team sports like that at the Olympics are round robin. And what's the theory there? You know, there's probably, I can think of three different types of sort of playoff systems where you play off one team against another to see who's best. The level number one, the simplest level, perhaps maybe the first level, was, you know, they just play each other. If you have two teams, they play each other. Now you know who's best. If you have four teams, well, two sets of two play each other, and then the winners play each other, and now you have the overall winner. Well, nowadays that's called single knockout. And the problem with it is, you know, one bad day, one bad referee, or let's say your best player is injured, or in the case of soccer, your best player could have a red card and be kicked out of the game. And then, you know, in the case of the World Cup, your country's fate is determined by a referee's wave of a red card. That's a little harsh. So the North American system of playoffs is to play more than one game. And so you have rounds of playoffs, and in these rounds, typically it's best of seven. Baseball, it's a little less than seven games in the first round, and then after that, it might be seven. Certainly in basketball, I think it's seven all the way through, and in hockey, it's seven games, best of seven all the way through. So what that means is you might have 16 teams going into the playoffs, which is too many. But it gets lots of playoff games, and fans like playoff games, so that's why they do it. So, those 16 teams play each other, and they play a best of seven. That means the first team to win four games goes on. And they also play, in each of those sports, they play until each game until somebody wins. There's no ties. And so, let's say you have 16 teams playing each other. Best teams win, that leaves eight teams. Now, those teams play each other the next round. That leaves you with four teams. Those teams play each other the next round. And then that leaves two teams. And then those teams play each other for the final. So that's four rounds of playoffs. A minimum of four games a round, but they have to budget for seven games, right? And in most of these sports, you don't play every night. You get at least some spacers in there. So a best of seven is probably budgeted at 2 weeks. Four rounds times 2 weeks, that's 8 weeks. That's 2 months of playoffs. That's a lot. For whatever reason, at the World Cup, they don't do this. They could. And it would be, let's say, somewhat fair. I think one of the problems is, I know in football and baseball, they have a sort of a fairness mechanism. Like in baseball, they introduced something called the wild card team. What that meant was you had teams finish the year according to the number of wins, like the team with the most wins was at the top of the rankings. And then the second most team and the third most team, whatever. And then they added another round of teams, another level of teams, and those are the wild card teams. And what that meant was, in your division, you might be the third team. And not only that meant you were out of the playoffs, but if you had a lot of wins, more wins than anybody else, then you became a wild card team. Now, this is a good idea. So this is a way of keeping things sort of localized, which you sort of need to do. I don't know why they do it, but maybe it's to do with, you know, certain markets, certain rivalries. They always want, you know, a New York team to play a New York area team kind of thing, an Eastern team to play an Eastern team, vice versa. So then the wild card teams was an attempt to add even more fairness and, of course, more games. And I believe in baseball, the wild card teams, they play, I thought it was a best of five. I don't know if it still is. You know, these things change year by year. But the nice thing is those top teams don't have to play that first round. So I think that's what it is. There's like a wild card round. And then they play like the second best team. I know in football, the lowest level teams play each other the first week of the playoffs. And then they play the top team in that division the second week of the playoffs. And then those top teams, the winners of the second round play the other winners of the second round. And then now you're ready for the Super Bowl round. I didn't explain that very well, but basically, if you finish tops in your division, you skip around the playoffs. So you get rewarded for finishing tops in your division. Well, there's no division in World Cup play. I guess that's like the fundamental problem. There's no workup of rankings. So teams come in essence, unranked. They are somewhat ranked within their sector. They call them groups. 8 groups go to the World Cup or in the World Cup. It's like dividing the world into 8 chunks. Well, again, these teams don't play each other than some pseudo-playoff games. And so, you know, you found out, okay, in this group, these are the best teams, these are the ones that go to the World Cup. But you don't know how that group compares to another group. So you end up having a problem that teams are coming into the World Cup and you don't know where everyone ranks. Hang on, Pete. You have some idea that teams deserve to be at the World Cup. And even that is sort of questionable. And the reason is that, you know, some parts of the world might have more good teams than other parts of the world. But once you get to the World Cup, you have to have some way of going, have we truly got the teams that should be here? And rather than doing a single round of knockouts, which, let's say at the World Cup you have like the best team, we'll call them Team A. And let's say in the first round of playoffs at the World Cup, the best team, Team A, plays Team B, the second best team of all the teams. And B gets knocked out. Well, the point is that if the system is sort of fair and, you know, the worst teams played each other and it sort of bubbled up like in seeding, like in tennis, they seed players. They have a chance throughout the entire year to measure the relative strengths and abilities of players and they rank them. And that becomes seeding for the major tournaments. And so if you're winning a lot of tournaments, when you go into Wimbledon, which is running this week, you'd be seeded very high. And again, high seeds don't play the first round in tennis, and then when they do play, they play the worst seeds. I think they have like 32 levels of seeds. They seed 32 players. So let's say the first round, the unseeded players played. The second round now, the number one seeded player plays like the number 32. And so they're trying to make it fair by getting rid of the lesser players. Well, you have this problem in soccer that you can't easily do that. So the soccer system, sort of out of necessity, like the Olympic one, is to play what's called round robin. And in a given group of 4 teams, one team has to face each of the other 3 teams. And it's interesting, in playoff hockey, you can play, I think, every other night, basketball every other night for sure. But in soccer, I think it's every 4 days. So they play a game, then they get 4 days off to recover. So you can imagine that first round, you have to play 3 games, you get 4 days to recover, that's a minimum of 12 days, and so the bottom line is the first round of the World Cup takes 2 weeks. And hopefully at the end of it, within a group, within each group, the best teams have risen to the top. And in some groups it's pretty obvious that this has happened. For example, some teams now, after the first round, have won all 3 of their games. Well, you can safely say that's the best team in that group, they beat everybody else. In other groups, it's not so clear. And of course, the famous group, the famous team, where it's not at all clear, is the U.S. The U.S. beat Ghana their first game, and it was a great game and a great effort. They then tied their next game. They were winning until literally the last minute, and Portugal scored in the last seconds. I think it was the last actual hit. The last contact of the game was Portugal tying the game. It was a heartbreak because now the U.S., instead of winning 2 games and automatically advancing, they were now still in the running with at least one other team, and if not 2 other teams, kind of thing. So then the U.S. plays their 3rd game against Germany and loses. But Portugal had a worse goal differential. In other words, they lost more in their opening game. They had a horrific opening game. Portugal being a great team and having a great player, arguably the best player in the world, Ronaldo. They lost like 5-0. It was just one of these blowouts that shouldn't happen. And luckily for Portugal, thanks to the round robin, they had another chance. But against the U.S. they only tied. And they ended up winning the 3rd game, but by losing badly and having a tie and a win, it wasn't enough. Well, the U.S. had exactly the same record as Portugal. A loss, a tie, and a win. But when the U.S. lost, they only lost by 1 goal, and Portugal lost by 4 or 5 goals. That's how the U.S. advanced. So, somewhat controversial, and there was a really great quote. Someone tweeted, Keith Olbermann, I'm confused about this soccer thing. How many games does the U.S. need to tie or lose to advance to the next round? Or to win the World Cup, they might have said. So the idea being that here was the U.S. losing and tying and losing and advancing. Anyway, such as it is, the U.S. has advanced. And now we get to see them playing real teams. Well, certainly better teams. And, you know, realistically, at some point, the U.S. is going to get knocked out. They're just not in the top tier. Speaking of top tier, though, I have to say the game of the week was Brazil versus Chile. Saturday morning, the first match of the playoffs of the next round. Round 16, as they call it. Brazil was the favorites, and they played Chile. Chile, South American team, Brazil, South American. The whole thing is being hosted in Brazil. So Brazil's a large country. They're just rabid soccer fans. Chile and South American countries in general, soccer's their thing. This is obviously going to be a big match. And Brazil is, you know, sort of famous. The players are famous for having like one name, started by Pelé and Ronaldo and Ronaldinho and various names, and continued to this day. One of the famous Brazilian players is called Fred, which is somewhat uncharacteristic, but there he is. Another guy is called Hulk. Turned out Hulk had a good game yesterday. A big guy, and starting in the second half, this guy just played really well and was almost a difference maker until the end. So, home team advantage, Brazil, you know, 90% of the... I think there was like 150,000 fans in the stadium. That's what someone said. I don't know if that was true. It's almost hard to believe. Because you just don't normally get those numbers in anything but soccer, watching a match. You know, football, you might get 50,000. The Rose Bowl, I think you get like 80,000 or 100,000. But in soccer, you can get 150. So, you know, everyone was sort of expecting Brazil to walk all over Chile. Well, it didn't happen. And the first half was so exciting, I watched it. I just stood there, literally stood in front of the TV and watched it. Because it's one of my favorite things in sports and team sports is to watch the team playing as a team versus the top-rated bunch of superstars pseudo-playing as a team. And this is what we had yesterday. Brazil, you know, Neymar is the guy that everyone's like, Neymar's the man kind of thing. And they were playing these Chileans who there just wasn't a particularly well-known player. But the Chileans were playing as a team. And it was just that heart and that effort. And Chileans kept themselves in the game. Brazil didn't get a big lead. And I don't remember the scoring by half. I do remember that in the second half, the Chileans had sort of played themselves out. They were bushed. They were worn out. And understandably so, right? When you're not quite as good a team as the other team, the only way you can keep up with them is by playing your guts out. And, you know, sort of by definition, it's harder to sustain that for the whole game. Still, they held on, they held on. And after a while, you could just sort of tell they were just holding on. And it was a tie game in the second half. So then it went to the 30 minutes of overtime. So now they've played two 45-minute halves. And in soccer, you don't get any commercial breaks. You can take a break by faking an injury, but you don't get many breaks. And then you get that halftime, 15 minutes, whatever it is, and then you're back at it again for another 45 minutes. It's interesting, nowadays they have technology they can track very accurately to like the 10th of a mile or 20th of a mile. They now track, I think automatically, how far each player has run during the game. And routinely, when you see these guys getting substituted off, they've run 7 miles. Which is to say, that's when they're substituted before the end of the game. So the players that stay in the whole game, they're going 10 miles. And 10 miles, probably half of that, they're sprinting. And you think about it, running and sprinting 10 miles, what kind of a workout that is. So these poor Chileans hanging on. So they get to the overtime, 2 15-minute periods. So they're already, everyone's already worn out. They go through the overtime and there's no goals scored. And they came super close. Oh, did they come close. The Chileans, in the last minute, number 9, I forget his name, Pinilla, took a great shot from well out and hit the crossbar of the goal. And it just ricocheted a mile off this crossbar. And it was just oh so close. Could have deflected in from hitting the crossbar, but no. And then it went to the other end, and even though the announcers didn't give it credit, one of the Brazilians shot at the other end and literally missed the goal by 6 inches. You know, ever since I commented on the poor color commentary for the soccer, I've been sort of being extra studious in how I listen and observe these commentators, both the play-by-play guy and the color guy. And there is one shining star, this Taylor character, who I think is an American. He's got an odd last name, which I'd recognize, but don't remember at the moment. He is spot on. He is a treat. His analysis and whatnot is great. But everyone else, they're pretty ordinary. They don't give a good play-by-play. Often they're talking about other stuff. It kind of reminds me in tennis. In tennis, the commentary, and these are professionals. This is John McEnroe and Patrick McEnroe and Cliff Drysdale and Brad Gilbert and a bunch of expert commentary people. But for some reason in tennis, it's like an old boys club. And they spend, I would say, half to three quarters of the time talking about something irrelevant to the game. And this is routine. The majority of the time, they're not really focused. And then every once in a while, they're like, oh, wow, did you see that? Hey, you know, we can do that at home. We can say that at home. So tennis commentary, other than John McEnroe's color commentary, tennis commentary is really disappointing. Well, these soccer guys are not much different. I was noticing, like, for example, yesterday, one of the commentators, you know, the ball would be passed from player to player to player to player, and he wasn't saying a single word. He wasn't even saying the name of the player. You know, he wasn't even saying Ronaldo to Fred to Hulk. You know, he wasn't saying anything. Nothing at all. And occasionally, you know, they tried to make a comment about the pace of play or whatnot, but I noticed that they were making those comments 10 minutes after I had already made the comment. It's kind of fascinating. And I think part of it is that in soccer, there's no breaks. It's the only sport I know of where there are no breaks for 45 minutes. The clock keeps running, without exception. Someone gets hurt, too bad, the clock keeps running. Yes, they do track the time, and they add onto each half what's called injury time. So if someone gets injured and it takes a minute to get them off the field, they add a minute of time. But technically, the clock keeps running. And for example, the commentators are forced to keep commenting. If the guy's getting treated, they keep commenting, and often they make a comment about whether they think the injury was justified or not. Another interesting thing about the game, speaking sort of in general, the refereeing is just so important, and one of the things a referee has to do is they have to keep control of the match. That means is, if you police something too closely, and this is really noticeable in some sports more than others. I think football, it's less noticeable. But hockey, it's very noticeable. Well, and what it comes down to is, what do you allow, especially in the playoffs? During the season, you know, if you take a run at somebody and hit them into the boards, you know, they call that boarding or cross-checking or whatever, and you get a penalty. But in the playoffs, they tolerate more of that. And they do it for two reasons. Number one is they don't want the referee to be the main factor in the game. And number two, they want the game to be more exciting. Well, you still have a balance. Because if you let too much happen, then the players just start going at each other. They're not even playing hockey or soccer anymore. They're just going at each other. And in soccer, what happens is, soccer is closer to basketball than it is to hockey. In other words, you don't allow too much contact in soccer. And also, the penalties are gray in soccer and basketball. And this makes the situation worse. In basketball, when you get a foul, it's not enough. Which is why, as I've commented in the past, basketball is the worst sport, foul-wise, because you benefit from fouls. Well, you can definitely benefit from fouls in soccer. Hockey, no. The penalties are too steep. So, it's up to the referee. You have to have your whistle ready in soccer. And as soon as things start to escalate a little bit too much, where things get a bit flagrant, you have to blow the whistle. And then the next level is, as soon as, you know, the people are a little dangerous, a little malicious with their checking and with getting their cleats in there and sort of like trying to injure the main player on the other team, you have to give a yellow card sooner. Well, this was really evident in one of the games yesterday where the referee didn't get in early. And then that match ended up setting a record for the number of penalties in the match. Penalty being, you know, you blow the whistle and you say, okay, here, you get the ball back, which is no penalty. And so it set a record for penalties because it didn't set a record for yellow cards. So that's too bad. I think soccer... Hang on, please. I think that soccer is very outdated. That's my conclusion this time round in the World Cup. When my father was alive, we had watched the World Cup. It was always a great experience. In other years, what I remember is how horrible the officiating was. How common taking a dive was, you know, players faking an injury. And how it just totally detracted from the play. I remember one year Cameroon sort of came out of nowhere in one year. This is maybe, getting towards 20 years ago. And they were just absolutely brilliant. They were one of the best teams of the match. And then they played Nigeria. And Nigeria were so dirty and cheap. And the refereeing was so bad. That was it. Cameroon got knocked out. Just by the refereeing or lack thereof. That's bad. Well, this time around in 2014, the refereeing is some of the best I've seen. But it's not enough. The game yesterday proved it. It's not enough. The refereeing was poor. The match was out of control. And the amount of diving, that's the other thing that happens when you get a lot of whistles, is at the World Cup and as you advance in the rounds, a given penalty becomes more of a penalty. In other words, if you get a yellow card and two yellows and you're out of the game, well, then they want the best player to get yellows, right? And so they just hound the guy, you know, hoping that he'll retaliate at some point, and then he gets a yellow card for that. This is all very tiresome stuff. It's non-soccer stuff. And what soccer needs is a more tiered structure, a structure with more steps. And then you can give people the appropriate punishment at each step. And they will consequence themselves out of the World Cup accordingly. That's what you need. Then you could say that soccer is the beautiful game. But honestly, soccer is only the beautiful game when the weather's good, so to speak. Speaking of bad weather, Brazil's a big country, and I guess Brazil has been accused of doing a few dirty tricks with the soccer. Some teams have to travel more than others, number one, and number two, some teams have to play in, you know, more humid parts of the country than other parts. The U.S., for example, in three matches, had to travel 9,000 miles. If you were in L.A., it's 3,000 miles to go to New York, then 3,000 back to L.A., and then 3,000 to New York. In other words, if you were playing three matches, one in L.A., one in New York, and one in L.A., you would have traveled... Well, actually, that would only be 6,000. They traveled more than that. It's like each game was across the country three times. Well, other teams didn't have that. Another thing was, normally they try and make it so that the final matches in the round robin are played simultaneously, because otherwise you sort of are watching the other match, and it's like if they lose, then we're okay, and you can sort of ruin a match because, well, the other team lost, and so now our match doesn't matter, we automatically advance, kind of thing. Well, I guess again, they mostly did that, but then with Brazil, they didn't do that. In other words, Brazil got to watch the other match before their final match, and then things didn't matter as much, and they were laughing. Also, some parts of the country, the humidity in that is horrific. The U.S. has had to play several games in extreme humidity and challenge. And sadly, like in the first game the U.S. played, due to the humidity, they think that's when one of the players pulled their hamstring, Altidore. And a lot of players have had hamstring and cramping issues because of the humidity. So, you know, these again take away from the soccer. But the biggest thing of all is you need to revamp it. I think a sport that has changed more than any sport, and we're talking at the big leagues, is football. Football is... There are a lot of rules, I won't deny that, but in terms of watchability, there's nothing like football. There was a special last night on, once again, part of the ESPN 30 for 30 series called You Don't Know Bo, about Bo Jackson, whose full name, by the way, is Vincent Edward Jackson, and he's known as Bo Jackson, or Bo. Bo Jackson has sort of, you know, been recognized somewhat after the fact as being the greatest athlete of the 20th century, basically. He had a short career, but he had two careers. He got hired first in baseball, Major League Baseball, and then he decided, hey, I'm also going to go into the NFL. Well, he ended up going to the All-Star Games in the NFL and in baseball. a remarkable, remarkable player. Just a natural talent. I mean, I think it's safe to say he worked on his talent in some ways. For example, he was kind of a bully when he was younger. He was part of a huge family in a super poor area. And he used to throw crab apples. They would have crab apple fights. You could hear him talking about it, and you realize, like, this was dangerous with a crab apple. But the point is that when you're throwing stuff, and I threw a lot of stuff when I was younger, you develop hand-eye coordination, you develop your arm, you develop throwing ability. Bo Jackson was also a big fighting type guy. I had to fight a lot. And again, that's going to develop your strength. But anyway, Bo Jackson was absolutely a remarkable player. And so as I was watching this special, and this is about the fifth or sixth time I've watched this special, Bo Jackson, he talks in such a modest way. He had such a fantastic career. He was so above everybody else that, well, as people put it, you know, the pros were watching Bo Jackson. As George Brett put it, when Bo Jackson was going to go up to bat, his teammates made sure they watched. George Brett put it that if you needed to go to the bathroom during a game, even if your teammates were up to bat, you'd go and use the bathroom. But when Bo Jackson was up, you didn't use the bathroom at that time. You know, story after story. The show was about an hour to hour and a half long. And I noticed at one point, it was like there was a couple of stories a minute, remarkable stories about Bo Jackson. When he was about to be signed, teams were pursuing him to sign him for Major League Baseball. Someone from the Yankees came down to see him, and they said, can you do some batting practice? And the coach said, hey, you know, batting practice, you know, the practice is over, sorry, come back tomorrow. And Bo Jackson said, I'll hit a few balls for you. So they go to the batting cage. And the coach throws Bo Jackson one ball. And Jackson hits it so hard, and it hits a corner of the cage. The cage collapsed. And the scout said, okay, I've seen enough. But this was just a typical story. But anyway, while watching this special, you get a chance to see football and hear people talk football. And I realized that despite the World Cup being on right now and being the dominant sport, my heart is definitely still with football, and football's about to start up again, and boy, am I looking forward to it. You know, you can have the Tour de France, and you can have the World Cup soccer, and you can have Wimbledon tennis, and you can have all these great major golf tournaments, and still, it's the off season. Football is not on right now. It's just such a superior sport. Yeah, so getting back to why. Football, the rules are changing constantly, being tweaked, and smart tweaks. For example, the last few years in football, they're making the game safer. You're not allowed to do head-to-head collisions in football anymore. This is great. There's just all kinds of stuff you're not allowed to do. There's something called a horse collar tackle. Well, Bo Jackson's career was shortened and ultimately ended by a somewhat horse collar-like tackle. He was running full tilt. A guy sort of grabbed him from behind, and the way he clamped onto one of his legs, Bo Jackson suddenly stopped from full speed to stopped in two steps, and he dislocated his hip and ended up severing a critical artery that then they didn't notice at the time, and then that ended up sort of atrophying or whatever, caused sort of a permanent injury to his foot. And that ultimately stopped Bo Jackson. No regular human could, but an injury ultimately did. Well, football has got rid of so many things, and there's always a hue and cry when you make each of these rule changes, but the game gets better, the game gets safer, the game gets more exciting. One of the things, I love punting. I mean, I love all aspects of football, but I love punting. And punting is when one team has tried, they've had their three downs, and now on the fourth down they punt it, they kick it to the other team. So it's a change of possession, as it's quaintly called. Well, when that punter is kicking it, the teams that are on the field are called special teams. There's a whole team in football just for these transitions, these changes of position. And it can be quite an exciting part of the game. These punters, my best punts, very best punts, are like 35 yards in the air, 40 if you count how far the ball rolls on the ground. Well, these kickers, their best punts are 60 yards in the air, and 80 if you count how far they roll on the ground. And those numbers are double mine, but what that really means is, because, you know, E equals MC squared, basically velocity squared is involved. And what it means is these guys are putting four times as much energy into that football than I am. And, you know, I'm good at punting. I love punting. And I'm almost like a golfer when it comes to punting. If I could, you know, if they scaled up the golf hole to allow a football to go into it, and if I was allowed to punt a round of golf, I could get a pretty good score. But I don't have the strength. It's partly because I came to it late in life. I came to it, you know, starting at age 40. That's when I started punting. You know, that's too darn old. I've never been a strong athlete in the first place. I'm very average. But punting is something where it's sort of a miracle what they can pull off with these punts. Well, anyway, what I'm getting at is one of the big changes in football was they don't show replays on punts now. So they do the kick, the guy catches the ball and runs it as far as he can back, and then they go straight to commercial. And so this has been a sort of a casualty of the commercialization of sports, that if they were to show a replay of that punt and a replay of the catch, super slow-mo and a little bit of analysis, that would take a minute. And that minute is a couple or three commercials. And we never see replays of punts anymore. But that's football moving with the times. That's football going, this is a less critical part of the game. And we want the most exciting parts mainly. Because admittedly, most punts are not interesting. The guy catches it, he gets tackled right away. Nothing much happens. It is just a change of possession, nothing more. Yeah, occasionally the guy runs it back all the way. Well, if he does, you'll see that replay. But if it's not that, i.e. 9 times out of 10, then you don't see the replay. So it's an okay change. Well, soccer needs drastic reworking. Here's some of my thoughts on soccer changes. You need to be able to stop the clock. You can't stay fresh as an announcer, as a color commentary person, when the clock is running for 45 minutes. You just can't do it. It's like me trying to stay fresh on my Floydcast for 45 minutes. It's difficult. And I have a lot of research going in. You know, I have a lot of material. And even then, I pause it periodically. And in the editing, I'm, you know, kind of ruthless. And in a 75-minute raw Floydcast, I end up getting rid of 20 minutes of that. That's not worth listening to. Chop it down to 55 minutes, you know. Well, there's no chopping down in soccer. And so a minimum of one-third of a soccer match is not worth watching or listening to. Now, I'm not saying they should cut out parts of it, but if you took more breaks and during the breaks showed replays, then that would remind everyone why this is a beautiful game. You need those replays. You need to see this is why that was so remarkable. You need more super slow-mo and more isolating, where you isolate on a given player and you go, here's the battle with Neymar, you know, that the opposition is physically checking him and being very rough on him, and then quickly show like five rough plays with Neymar in them. Well, they do this in other sports. They don't do this in soccer. It's all because the clock is running and you can't stop and show replays. I was watching the game yesterday and I was noticing you'd see a great kick or whatever and there was no replay. And the ball had gone out of bounds. It had gone for a corner kick. So someone was going to kick it back into play. And I counted. And 20 seconds went by. They had 20 seconds to show a replay. I mean, you can show a replay quickly if you want to. They do it in football all the time. There's about 20 to 30 seconds between each football play. Between the time one play ends and the time the next play starts. Because they have to do a huddle and they have to, you know, the officials have to line up the ball and everything else. And they just allow a certain amount of time because you've got to get everybody set and ready. Well, during that time, they'll show two and three replays in football. So for every play in football, there's two or three replays. Yeah, it's really nice on the replays. You've got to elevate the great parts of the game. Well, if you're not showing any replays of great parts of a soccer game because there's no time, you can't fit it in, that's a problem. So number one, you're not seeing the great parts repeated. And number two, you're not seeing them from multiple angles. And number three, the announcers are getting stale and bored, and they can't possibly be fresh. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. You can't take a boring part of the play and make it interesting. The officiating, horrendous. it's a fundamental problem with soccer that there's like these incidental levels where you blow the whistle and you give the guys a penalty kick, but it's a meaningless kick in most cases. No one gains any advantage. It's like in the basketball, you give them a free throw, but it's meaningless. The team that got penalized didn't get penalized because they gained a rest break from doing it. And it's true in basketball and it's true in soccer, and that whole structure has to change. I think that the way you change that is you have tiered penalties. You give that yellow card more readily, or you introduce a two-minute penalty box type penalty. They did this in rugby. Rugby did not used to have it. And today, rugby has a two-minute penalty where you go into a penalty box. This is needed in soccer. It's obvious. You have a player that's a problem. You don't want to give him a yellow card, which could lead to him being, you know, thrown out of the game and huge consequences for the soccer team. And so you give him the two-minute penalty first. Well, you take a good player and you put him on the sidelines for 2 minutes and have your team play shorthanded for 2 minutes. You change the whole tone of the game. You get rid of the cheap stuff. And then the idea that when you get kicked out of a match, your team plays one person short the rest of the match, get rid of that idea. No other sport does this. Not a single other one does it. When you get kicked out of the game, you get kicked out of the game, period. Nothing else happens. You know, maybe what you could do is like the 2 minutes. Someone gets kicked out of the game, but at that point, before they get kicked out, they get a 2 minute penalty. So your side plays short for 2 minutes. Then the player that caused the problem is kicked out of the game, but your side has 11 men again. Well, the point is that you've got to be introducing more penalties. You've got to have more levels of penalties, and they have to be fairer levels. Another thing soccer needs, you need an off-field ruling. Right now, there are blatant things that happen in soccer that never get caught, never get noticed. There was a goal yesterday that was scored. It was an own goal. If Team A got scored against, it wasn't Team B that scored it. It was a player on Team A that was the last person to touch it before it went into his own goal. So they call that an own goal. Well, they never changed the scoring for that goal the whole game. Even though they knew it, the replay showed it, it was clear. In hockey, they would change this. In hockey, you get a goal scored, and then a little while later, they review it, and they're like, oh, it was deflected off of this person. That changes who scored it, and they change who gets credited with the goal. It's like a standard phrase. Probably once every other game you hear, so-and-so has been credited with the goal. It's just a routine thing. And it's using an off-field intelligence to make the game more fair. Hang on, Pete's again. If you don't bring fairness in, then the game is unfair. When the game is unfair, it's not watchable. That's where soccer is today. I gotta say, overall, I'm a little bit disappointed by soccer. I'm a little bit saddened by it. For example, yesterday, the first half was great. The second half wasn't. One team was worn out. Well, they didn't have any way to make up for it. The announcer started dragging. It was interesting how in the second half, in the first half I watched the game so closely, I was standing up staring at the TV. In the second half, right away, I could just instantly sense it wasn't going to be the same half. And I never watched the game in the second half directly. I had the TV on, I was listening to it, but I wasn't watching it. I was doing something else. And it took the announcers 15 minutes to realize that it was a different game in the second half. It took them like another 10 minutes to realize that, you know, Chile was worn out. That's what had happened. And so they were playing defensively and just getting rid of the ball rather than trying to launch attacks themselves. So, soccer has its moments, but honestly, I think I'm at a bit of a low ebb when it comes to soccer this year. Even though the officiating is better than it has been, and thank goodness a bunch of teams I really can't stand are out of the World Cup. That's always a good thing. Teams that don't deserve to be there, and teams that are cheaters, they're out of the World Cup, and I'm very happy about that. But still, there's a lot of it. Okay, so, seeing as this has become the soccer cast, I didn't know what I was going to be talking about, but it looks like it's going to be soccer, and even I'm going to barely fit it all in. I watched England playing a soccer game this year. England was already up by the end of the second match. They were going home. But they got to do their three games, right? So they played Costa Rica. This game was almost unwatchable. England played so bad. And I started counting right off the bat. I started doing a little bit of statistical analysis. The first 10 times that England, players from England, touched the ball, 8 out of those 10 first touches were headers. they headed the ball 80% of the time. Another play, the ball is on the 2-yard line of the other team. Basically, you are very close to their goal. You're about as close as you can get from the sideline. The English player throws it in. The next thing you know, the ball has gone back to their own half of the field. They went minus 48 yards in 3 seconds. They passed back and passed back, and they took a scoring position, a threatening position, and turned it into nothing. Occasionally, and this is in the first few minutes that I was watching and sort of statistically recording things, players tried to dribble with the ball. They'd go 3 feet and get the ball checked away from them. One case, they tried to pass to a striker, someone trying to score. They missed the guy by 10 yards. This would be like trying to throw the ball in baseball to somebody and throwing it directly into the stands at a 45-degree angle. After watching about 10 or 15 minutes of this and realizing, wow, this team is like way worse than even my own memory of them, I typed into Google, are there any good English soccer players? The very first hit, the story was entitled, England isn't suited to playing good football, and they shouldn't bother trying. I've got the link to that, which eventually, hopefully I'll be organized and I'll put that up online. And that's when it hit me. Not only is England old-fashioned, the coaches are hideously, horrendously ill-suited, but the style of play. And that's when I realized that the English Premier League, which is, you know, Premier, right, the top, the great players aren't English anymore. The good players are coming from other countries. So no wonder when England goes to the World Cup, it isn't just that they're a bunch of... I sort of perceive them as being a bunch of superstar guys who are having a great old time in the Premier League making tens of millions, and then they go to the World Cup and they're like, yeah, I guess we should get our act together, and they don't do a good job. It isn't that at all. There aren't good players from England. Well, then the question is, why in the lead-up to the World Cup do they always make a big thing about England, and how is England going to do, yada yada? England isn't going to do anything. They suck. Wow, that was kind of an eye-opener. So why don't the analysts figure that out? So basically, the history of soccer is it. Modern soccer was originated in England, but soccer has left England far behind. This is embarrassing. This would be like, imagine what would happen if football left, this is North American football, American football, left America behind. Imagine what would happen if suddenly, you know, it's humorous to think of another country, but let's say, imagine if France suddenly played American football better than Americans. You know, it's horrific to imagine it. I'll tell you one sport where it's happening a little bit, and that's baseball. The Japanese love baseball. And there are a lot of really good players from Japan who are now coming over to the American baseball, MLB, Major League Baseball. Tanaka was just in the news. Ichiro is famous playing in America. There's a bunch of them. So, you know, you got to keep at the top of your game or else you don't deserve to, you know, be treated that way. Wikipedia says that soccer is played by 250 million people in over 200 countries and it's the world's most popular sport. This year, the World Cup, Costa Rica finished the top of their group, which was really amazed everybody. But in playing against England, Costa Rica beat England. I mean, played better, and that was like, wow, Costa Rica is a nothing team. How could they possibly be playing better than England? At least Portugal, who had a horrible first game, at least they redeemed themselves, tied the States and beat Ghana. So this is sort of my overall realization about soccer, that it isn't the beautiful game, not currently, and it needs to be revised. Well, the same is true of our collective estimate of England. The England soccer team is horrible. We need to call a spade, as I sort of summarized in my little notes here about the game. I said, in settling down to watch this game, I thought the reasons for England's poor play were going to be complicated. They weren't. Wow, England. I just realized that I've had this thought before, this disgusted thought about England's play level. And that was when I offered up that quote a couple of podcasts ago about every society colors its own decline with illusions. Well, it's time to call England what it is. In soccer, they stink. Their movies stink. Their cars stink. The society has declined dramatically, and give the raspberry to England. All right, there was one last thing soccer-wise for the week. A Uruguayan player, Luis Suarez, bit another soccer player. Well, the really astounding thing was this player has bitten other players before, not once, but twice before. Why is this guy still allowed to play soccer? And he plays, guess where, the Premier League. He plays for an English team in the Premier League. Well, there's something rock going on here. Why is this guy allowed? What? So he got a big fine, equivalent in American dollars of like over $100,000 fine, and he's not allowed to play for 4 months, and it works out to being 9 matches, and it could be, you know, quite a few international matches as well. I don't know why he wasn't kicked up early. I don't get it. He had some lame excuse. It's Mike Tyson all over again. Well, Mike Tyson was banned from boxing forever by his bites. Why wasn't this guy? Let's look at his name. Luis Suarez. Luis, L-U-I-S, is a 347. Suarez, 999. Well, 999 is that tragedy combination. Tragic things happen to them. But there's some other things we can say about these two combinations. With the 999, it's also a quality that the 9 has a sudden onset of temper and then a sudden strong level of regret. So it's a fast flashing or flaring up of temper and then a strong feeling of regret and, you know, they suddenly care again. Well, you have to have a pretty sudden flash of temper to bite somebody. I mean, 1 minute you're playing soccer and the next minute you're biting someone. That's pretty bizarre. The other thing is, so with his name, Luis Suarez, it's 347-999-347 total, 7 deaths. Okay, so if we analyze that 347, basically the 9 just adds power to the other numbers. If we analyze his first name, then we also analyze his total, and we analyze the whole person. So he comes down to that first name. Well, what did they say about the 347? I remember what one Caballerian student told me about the 347. They just said, well, that person's crazy. The 347 is super sensitive, and it is a name that inclines the person towards being obsessed due to that super sensitivity. Well, I think it's safe to say that when this guy was biting, in the process of biting other players, he was in a moment of insanity. So that's our Mr. Suarez. He has a name that makes him too sensitive, and the first name, the last name, causes him to flare up, to sort of have an extreme, well, an extreme personality, extreme reactions. And the two together, he shouldn't be playing soccer. He should have a better name. Anyway. And in the same game, I think earlier it had happened, a guy got a red card. Well, he got kicked out of a game. Well, this is a bit of an event in soccer. It doesn't happen too often, even at the World Cup level when, you know, 32 teams are playing. Well, what's his name? The guy's name was Claudio Marchisio. Well, Marchisio is our favorite combination, 775. Accident looking for a place to happen. His accident was he gets a red card. His team plays shorthanded the rest of the game, and he's out. Well, he's out of that match and the next match or something like that. So, the name combinations strike again. I'm going to do some updates. Maybe I'll continue with the name updates. For some reason, I ran across a story. You know, you click a story and they suggest a bunch of other stories to you, and then you look at those and they suggest other stories. The next thing you know, you're off on a tangent. My tangent yesterday was famous people that had died in 2013. My own top-of-the-list person was Peter O'Toole. Such a superb actor. He did pass away last year, sadly. But so did James Gandolfini. This is our Tony Soprano guy. Now, I tried watching The Sopranos. Horrible, hideous crap. Why is it on TV? Why are people making a big thing of it? I don't know. Well, anyway, let's look at James Gandolfini, his name. Gandolfini is 731, James 663. So 663, 731, 494 total. Well, the 494, we've actually talked about this before, I think last week, when we talked about someone who got cancer. The problem with that 494 is they love heavy foods, especially meat, and then their elimination is slower than normal. So you're eating a food that's the hardest to eliminate, and your elimination is slower than other numbers, the worst, slowest elimination. The double whammy means cancer and heart disease. And this guy, he died of a heart attack at age 51. That's pretty young. And by the way, the heart is the 7. Gandolfini, 731. So he had the heart in the last name, and he had the cancer total. It's not really a surprise that he died young at age 51. Here's a Yelp update. Yelp is a service that it rates your local businesses, supposedly, but it doesn't have a down mod. You can't say, hey, I don't like this guy's rating. I don't like this guy's comment. Yelp has three ways to categorize a review, and they are truly absurd. I encourage you to go to Yelp and find out what they are. Like, they're such bizarre words. They're like, I found it, that review cool or awesome or wonderland. They're just from outer space. Yelp is from outer space, and their ratings of their comments are from outer space. Well, anyway, there's a story last week of criminals saying, send us money in the form of bitcoins. Bitcoins are an e-currency, a digital currency, a new thing. They're a bit of a scam, but they allow anonymity. So these guys, these criminals were saying, send us bitcoin, i.e. anonymous money, or we'll hate spam you on Yelp. This is good, because it's anti-Yelp. And this is like saying, Yelp, you guys, you've got a badly designed system. So that's the good thing about this story, was it shows the weakness of Yelp. Anyway, you know, I do wonder, like, if you're at the Yelp company and this story comes out, is there anyone there holding a meeting, top level meeting, and going, we got to do something? I'll bet no. Partly because Yelp is 584, it's not a good combination. This is why Yelp stinks as a service. It has a bad combination. 584, let's look at it. The 5 is critical. Well, Yelp certainly allows for criticism. Maybe that's like the dominant trait of Yelp. Reviews is critical, but not balanced. Certainly the 5 is highly unbalanced, maybe the most unbalanced of all numbers. And then Yelp, it's 584, then it has the 4 quality. So it thinks fivishly and critically, and then it expresses fourishly and cautiously. Well, that caution is going to manifest right now in the lack of desire for change. So Yelp is an obviously poorly designed service that's not going to change, just based on this combination. So at some point Yelp is just going to disappear, which can't happen soon enough. Got a story here this last week. Excess alcohol consumption responsible for 88,000 deaths yearly. Why is it coming up? Here's my, you know, sort of general point about that is, if 88,000 people are dying a year from alcohol, why is it something that we talk about occasionally in a story? You know, this story, the way it sort of comes out, it sort of makes it seem like, hey, we just discovered something. Alcohol is one of the oldest drugs. These people have been dying every year for every year the alcohol's been around, basically thousands of years. Why is this sanctioned and allowed at the top levels of government? Well, government makes money on alcohol, right? The tax on alcoholic beverages is really high. In Canada, it's super high. I think it's not quite as bad in America, but governments make money from selling alcohol, so they sell it. It's a strange thing. And they're saying 1 in 10 people die from excess drinking. And they define it as 5 or more drinks a week for men. This is binge drinking now. 5 or more drinks for men, 4 or more for women. And heavy weekly alcohol consumption is 15 drinks or more for men and 8 or more for women. Well, the average per week is 4. Heavy drinking is 15. Can you see the problem here? The problem is that the average and the heavy are really close together. It's only a factor of 4. Well, this comes back to my toxic talk and video. I realized that, you know, the whole thing of, you know, drink a glass of wine a day, it's good for you, that was a lie. Toxicity-wise, alcohol, half a drink a day is your limit. And even then, you know, why would you want to be close to your limit? The point is, it's not good for you at any level. It's a toxin. And it's one of the great toxins of human culture, humankind. The most toxic things are hidden from us, not talked about, occasionally talked about, like, it's a news story. 88,000 people died from booze last year. Let's talk about it for 1 week. And then not talk about it the next week. Isn't that pathetic? So, the good thing about my toxic document was that it thoroughly researches the field of toxic things. And then it ranks them. the relative toxicity. And sadly, in the relative toxicity world, alcohol doesn't even rank as high as green tea. If you have a regular green tea habit, you're doing more harm to yourself than if you're drinking alcohol. Oh man, what a screwed up world. And now, if you eat powdered eggs, you're probably doing 10 times as much harm to yourself as if you drink alcohol. Just from powdered eggs. All due to the fluoride. Wow. And if you're minding your own business and living as healthy as you can think to live, and avoiding green tea, and avoiding fluoride, and avoiding alcohol, and tobacco, and meat, and pharmaceuticals, you can still be thoroughly and effectively killed by microwave radiation. Wow, what a world, man. So that's my toxic update. I don't have a wireless update this week. And the reason I don't is there's been too many wireless stories. The reason I don't have an update this week is I did it last week, right? I did sort of mainly a wireless issue last week. Well, there's been a dozen stories in the last week because Google has a conference called I.O. I.O. is a computer term, input-output. So that's the name of Google's conference. Anyway, they have announced just a horde of wireless-type products. We'll just leave it at that. All right, I'm going to get to my of the weeks. I enjoy the of the weeks, and I'm sort of realizing that they're good to have. They allow me to balance out the lengths of my talks. If the talk is a little shorter than normal, then I can do of the weeks, and if it's a little longer, I can skip them. Some of them are, you know, a little lighter subject matter, which is good. There's some common themes in life. For example, we all sort of watch something each week or we listen to something each week. We all have a driver of the week story. And so it's good to sort of share, commiserate, and maybe learn from it. Okay, bad driver of the week. A study looking at the associations between driving time and health-related behaviors and outcomes has found that longer driving time was associated with higher odds for smoking, insufficient physical activity, short sleep, obesity, and worse, physical and mental health. This is kind of a confusingly worded little sentence, but what it's saying is those who drive a lot tend to do all these other sort of unhealthy things, like smoke and don't get enough physical activity, don't get enough sleep, tend to be overweight, and have physical and mental issues. So basically what they're saying is driving is unhealthy. And they're saying, then there's the second sentence that I quote here, driving for more than 2 hours a day had the most consistent associations with the majority of outcomes. So, you know, you drive 2 hours a day, and there are people that they commute and drive 2 hours a day. It's unhealthy. Try and minimize it. Part of that bad driver of the week thing is when something is unhealthy, no matter how hard you try, you're going to have bad moments just because the activity is fundamentally unhealthy. An example that comes to mind is, you know, fluoride is fundamentally unhealthy. And so if people are consuming fluoride, you're going to have people dying from it. And you absolutely do. People die from ingesting fluoride in the form of toothpaste. Kind of horrific numbers. It's like a person a week dies from fluoride overdoses, direct fluoride overdoses, not cumulative ones, which the rest of us die from. And from the gel treatments at the dentist, you swallow the whole thing, you're a kid, you die, you know. So driving is unhealthy, and factor that in. Think of it like the consumption of the 80s, you know, we overconsumed and we were sort of opulent and we had big cars and everything, and we've changed from that, right? We're a kinder, gentler world. Well, we have to become kinder and gentler in our driving by doing less of it. My rewatch of the week. I guess I've already talked about the You Don't Know Bo. Such great quotes in that. When you have a really good documentary, there's such good quotables in there. You know, if it's a regular movie, like let's take Casablanca, you know, with Humphrey Bogart, you know, consider this great movie, and or take Gone with the Wind, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. You know, these kind of famous quotes from these movies. You talking to me? Talking to me from, I think it's Taxi, De Niro movie. You know, some movies, they're quotable, but they're irrelevant. Frankly, my dear, I don't care. You know, you talking to me? Those are not significant thoughts. But when you get to a documentary, what makes it poignant is the truth of it. I just typed out a couple of quotes from the You Don't Know Bo documentary. Bo Jackson summarizing his life, he said, because they asked him, would you change anything? Doing it all over again, would you change anything? And he said, you know, I wouldn't. He said, I did things my way. And he said, I danced to the beat of my drums. Well, did he ever? For example, Bo didn't like practice. He just wasn't into it. Didn't see the point of it. He said it was a waste of time. Well, he was so brilliant without needing to practice. Who could argue with that? The other thing Bo Jackson said was, he said on his tombstone or his epitaph, he wanted to just say, here lies a ball player. That's it, nothing else. He was modest through and through. And this is partly what makes a great person, is that modesty. And you just have your basic points, your concepts, your basic approach to life, and then you just carry through on it. So, rewatched You Don't Know Bo, I watched it like it was the first time. I've watched this 5 or 6 or more times, and for a documentary, it only came out, what, in the last year and a half? To watch it 6 times in a year and a half, and to, you know, that's every once every 3 months, and to, I mean, I was watching it without doing anything else. There's such a density of quotes and stories in that documentary. It's wonderful. A great rewatch. Got my cool thing of the week was the new look of ESPN's Sports Center. Periodically, ESPN will redesign how ESPN looks, the interface of the channel. If you have a channel like the History Channel, it doesn't redesign itself. I think the closest thing that channels get to it normally is they add annoyingly different things that pop up on the screen all the time. For example, it used to be when you'd watch a channel, you didn't know what channel you were on because they didn't display the channel. And now when you watch a channel, they'll have like an identifier at the bottom right corner usually, which will say, you know, it's a big capital H for the History Channel. Well, then in the last few years, they started animating them. And then, if you're lucky, the thing will pop up in an animated style, and then it'll, if you're lucky, it'll settle down to a slightly muted version of that, which will never go away the whole show. So that's what most channels do. That's their branding. And boy, is it ever branding. It's a good word for it. Well, ESPN is a cool channel. It's a real channel. And it's a slick, awesome, cool, pick your adjective, great channel. And it is so in part because nobody puts more into the look of their channel than ESPN. I remember some years back, it might be three years back, ESPN went to the widescreen format. You know, TVs just 5 years ago, we were all watching old-style TVs mostly. Okay, maybe let's say 10 or 15 years, the wide format TVs have started to come out, also known as, you know, sort of high definition, but sort of that panoramic, it's a different aspect ratio is what it is. The height to the width changed, let's say 10 or 15 years ago. But nothing else changed. The TV shows themselves didn't change. Some TVs were kind of slick, and they offered a way to scale an old TV show format ratio to the new display. But they did it by stretching things and making things look unnatural. Well, sports is something that lends itself to high definition, to quality presentation, to a wider, more information presentation. And 5 years ago, something in that range, the sports broadcasts for like routine things like football and whatnot, they just started showing them in that wide format. It wasn't a scaled format, it was a wide format. And they even started targeting their graphics to people who had wide format TVs. And what happened was, if you had an old TV, things got chopped off. And at work, I used to watch a lot of TV at work, because as a care person, you spend a lot of time watching TV, because if your client is busy sleeping or doing something else, well, you got to be there and you got to be awake, and so you're watching TV a lot. And they don't spend them a lot of money on anything in these group homes, and so the TV is an old, lousy TV, old format usually. And so you'd be watching something and things would be all chopped off. You couldn't see the score. I remember for a while there, and it was on NBC in particular, you couldn't read the score because they didn't crop it properly for the old TVs, and so you literally couldn't see the score. And certain channels were like that. You know, so ESPN, I remember when they switched SportsCenter, and they have their stories on the side, and then they have the main part of the screen is where you see the guys talking. But they had like a what's coming up on the stories on the side. And they started really getting into that about 5 years ago, and they're putting a lot of, you know, good stuff there. But they put it there in a way that if you didn't have a wide format TV, you couldn't read it. And if you didn't have high definition, which costs more money, you couldn't read it because it was like in a small font. Anyway, we upgraded our TV and I, you know, got with the program, and so I remember that SportsCenter's change 5 years ago because I couldn't read it. So it was like out of necessity I had to upgrade. Well, this time around, ESPN has just upgraded out of the blue. Suddenly, they have this new studio, they have new graphics, and wow, does it look fantastic. It is so good. You have to see it to believe it. You can't begin to talk about it. In the new studio, it's like, it feels 5 times bigger than the old one. They have 100 monitors. And again, it each generation, I mean, think about it, in the original TV studio, you wouldn't have any monitors. When Walter Cronkite was talking, there was no monitors. There was just him and a desk. And, you know, even 20 years ago, you might see a monitor for certain things. But in like ESPN, you know, starting, let's estimate 10 years ago, they'd do things like they would have monitors built into the, you know, they stand at a very fancy desk. The thing that the analysts stand or sit at, like a booth almost, would have a graphic of some sort at the front, and it was usually static. Well, then they started putting TV screens on the front, and the TV screens could change and display stuff. Well, now with this redesign of ESPN, they got the monitors behind them. They still have their, like, their little booth-style thing, but that's, like, almost invisibly, ridiculously small. They now have a giant screen behind them that must be, I'm going to guess, 60 monitors. And when I say 60, I mean 60 of large screen TVs, all joined, seamlessly joined together. I have yet to be able to distinguish a seam of any kind between the monitors. I don't know how they did it. It just looks so shiny and bright. And then when you couple it with new graphics, new animations, you know, CNN was one of the first to come up with some striking visuals. And they became famous like at the Gulf War and that, where you had like these tickers on the bottom. CNN, you know, became famous for its tickers of news. But then when you had breaking news, then you had like a breaking news ticker, and you had the other ticker at the bottom, and you might have a third ticker or other pop-ups. And of course, you know, CNN got carried away with it. Well, everyone else got the message though. And tickers are now common, especially on sports channels, because there's sports happening constantly. Person A might care about soccer, person B cares about Wimbledon, which is on today, you know, and person C cares about baseball, which is on. And then all these other sports, golf is on. And Tiger Woods played golf this last week. He came back from his back surgery of 3 months ago. He came back in less than 3 months' time, and he played 2 somewhat okay rounds. He didn't qualify for the weekend, but at least he's back, and that's good. Well, how do you keep track of all these sports, all these stories? You have a ticker. The tickers have gotten better over the years. The problem with a ticker is that you have to keep reading it. If you miss part of it, then you've missed something important. So the algorithms and the software behind the ticker are really important. One, you want the ticker to be current, but you want it to replay the most important things. Number 2, you want it to cover everything. Number 3, you want it to be visually striking enough so that you can easily parse or read the information. Well, the new ESPN ticker is all that and more. It's now visually beautiful. It's more effective. It has higher contrast. It's more readable. But then they've done things like the top 10. SportsCenter is famous for its top 10 list, like the 10 greatest plays of the day. And now the graphics that go into those top 10, it's kind of like Letterman did this. Letterman had his top 10, and then he came up with some, when he moved to the Ed Sullivan Theater, he came up with some pretty good graphics that introduce his top 10. Well, ESPN has some very slick graphics that not only introduce the top 10, but also as you're showing each of the numbers. It's the kind of stuff that you normally don't talk about. It's filler. But oh, what beautiful filler. This is the greatest filler ever. You know, ESPN is truly a HD channel. Sports is truly worthy of high definition. ESPN once again has so nailed what sports fans are looking for. Thank you, ESPN. All right, I'm going to finish up with a quote of the week. I'm going to go with a quote that we've heard before. The quote is, "I'd rather be lucky than smart." You know, there are quite a few people that would rather be lucky than smart. And, you know, on the surface, you can go, yeah, that makes sense. Because let's take, for example, you win the lottery, right? You got millions of dollars, right? You were lucky. Bang, you're set for life, right? In our non-critical perception and analysis of that, we go, yeah, that's what I want. I want to win the lottery. I want to retire. But let's contrast two things. Let's compare winning the lottery to accomplishing something significant with your life. And so my question is, which of those would you rather do? Well, there's only one choice there. You want to do something significant with your life. Because here's the thing, if you don't, why are you living your life? What's the point? Why do you get up in the morning? Do you get up in the morning just to have a cup of coffee? As good as pizza is, I don't get up in the morning to have a cup of pizza. It's a nice start to the day, but it gets me going. It gets me wanting to accomplish. It has a purpose. I would encourage people, just as a self-evaluation, look at yourself, look at your life and going, am I working to win the lottery, i.e., is my focus on putting money in the bank, earning more money, compromising my own integrity so that I don't lose my job, so that I don't lose reputation? I don't want to have an opinion because, you know, if you have an opinion, then you might lose some sales. How many of us are doing that with our life versus how many are saying, this is what I stand for, this is where I'm coming from, if I don't like the show, I get up and leave. That's how I was raised. When my dad didn't like the show, we left. We got up and left. How many people do that in the movie theater? Go to a movie theater and take a look around, sit near the back, and watch. How many people leave the theater at some point in the movie? I'll tell you who leaves. People leave because they get a cell phone call, and they're like, oh, we got a crisis at home, we got to go home. That's who leaves. That's about it. There aren't too many that leave because the movie is so horrible. And yet, 99% of movies are horrible, but they're filler. And if you're just trying to get through your day and every day is the same as every other day in your mind, then one bit of filler is as good as the next. I think this is why people watch so many different TV shows. So many unwatchable TV shows get watched by so many people. When you watch on like a Jeopardy type show where they ask people trivia questions, the number of people that know so much about such irrelevant shows and irrelevant movies, and they know a level of detail that is basically unhealthy. So, there's my quote for the week. Would you rather be lucky or smart? Would you rather win the lottery or accomplish something significant with your life? Think about that. Come to terms with that. And don't shortchange your life. Accomplish something significant. Choose that choice. Yeah, you still want to be lucky. Why? Because if you win the lottery and you're trying to accomplish something, then you can use some of your lottery money to better accomplish something. But keep the significance to your life, to your attitude, to your analysis. Because if you don't have that, you won't have analysis. You won't have standards. And you won't have a reason for being alive. So, this has been Floyd Maxwell, doing a Floydcast number 20 for June 30th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.